Today's episode of Trackin' Food on the Mid-Range Podcast Network is brought to you by Scout. If you're wanting to learn more about Vancouver's food and cultural sphere with regards to community news, new restaurant openings, essential guides to some of the city's best offerings, as well as who's hiring, Scout is where you should go. You can find them at scoutmagazine.ca. That's scoutmagazine.ca. And if you're on Vancouver Island, they also have a sister website called Islandist. Same type of content, only island-driven. That's islandist.ca. We're proud to have Scout as our presenting sponsor, as we believe what they scout out is an excellent complement to what we're offering here on Trackin' Food. Do check them out. Once again, that's scoutmagazine.ca. Windy Monday afternoon. My name is Jamie Ma, host as always, and joining me with a nice, he looks good today. His name is Mickey McLeod, this is my co-host. How are you today, Mickey?
I'm good. I was riding yesterday, and the wind resistance was absolute insanity. I came over the Cambie Street Bridge, and then obviously, for people who don't know, the studio is off the Arbutus Ridgeway, and the whole ride back was like double hard because of the wind. It was like so crazy. And I was like, oh, I guess I just must be not in shape anymore. And I haven't been on my bike that much. And then I got here and like all the trees in my neighborhood were like, so yeah, it was windy.
Yeah. It's been, it reminds me of being back home in Saskatoon because that's a very prominent thing in Saskatchewan in the prairies. It's flat, windy.
Ain't no hills or trees to block that wind.
Yeah.
It rolls right through.
Would you say you're in tip-top shape physically right now? Are you in the best shape of your life?
I'm almost in the worst shape I've ever been in my life. I'm probably 20 pounds heavy, but I decided not too long ago, a few days ago, that I'm going to ease off on the booze a little bit and start a couple, you know, regular physical exercise, sort of maintain my diet a bit more. It's kind of, I've had a fun, you know, almost 3 months. Now it's time to get a little bit more serious about my physique.
You want that beach bod, don't you?
Yeah. If I can even get there, I don't know. It might be years. Who knows?
What have you been eating?
Oh, you don't want to know.
No?
Yeah. Next question.
Come on, you got to give me some stuff here.
It's like vegan comfort food. Jesus. It's kind of a double-edged sword. We live in Vancouver because you can eat plant-based or you can eat vegan. Two very different things.
Yeah. So how you been? How's the week been for you since we last chatted?
Been good. I'm very excited for people to hear this episode. We were fortunate enough to have on
editor-in-chief of Scout Magazine, my boss, Andrew Morrison. So me and him were chatting for a little bit here. We were talking about some stuff in the industry and I haven't actually spoken to him for quite a while now. So we're doing everything via email. And I was like, you know, I'd like to hear your voice. Why don't you come on the podcast? Let's talk about, you know, we talked about this episode today. We talked about the state of dining and what we think about the future of dining and how restaurants are right now and how they're handling kind of a lot of the, you know, all the nonsense that, you know, we've been rambling about for the last couple episodes here, get his thoughts on some of that, you know, especially since he doesn't actually own a restaurant, but he, you know, works in the industry. He's definitely very connected to it because he, you know, communicates with a lot of restaurateurs. And we talked about, you know, some patio stuff, all that stuff that kind of happened with Como this past weekend. And then, you know, he definitely was swearing a lot. I will say that he swore quite a lot in this one.
I feel like it's a kind of thing that happens when people come on our show. I don't know. I'm usually the one to drop the first swear word, yeah, and then it kind of just snowballs from there. Yeah. But I don't know.
Yeah, no, he was letting him go today, so it was good. He was very thorough and very eloquent in a lot of things he was talking about, and it was good. And we talked about a little bit of music there near the end, and so yeah, this is a good episode. It was nice to chat with him. It's always nice to get the perspective of someone like Andrew, who definitely understands the industry very well and someone who's well versed in a lot of things that, you know, kind of going on. And yeah, outside of that, my week was pretty good. I mean, you and I hung out a couple days ago, which was nice. And, you know, I urge anyone, by the way, who, if you've never watched, John Oliver, by the way, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, I watched last night's episode on, and it was fantastic. I'd say it's probably one of the best episodes he's ever done. I urge anyone, if you've never seen it, to watch last night's episode. It was really, the way they ended it was pretty powerful. And, otherwise than that, you know, this is, I feel like the world is falling apart in some ways. So
it is, literally.
There
might not be a post-2020. We don't know.
I'm not qualified to talk too much about what's going on in the world right now, but I will say that Solidarity is coming from me and Mickey, and definitely our podcast with the Black Lives Movement.
Yeah, it's you know, our support. Obviously, any decent human being sees what's going on and is completely appalled. So education, you know, thoughts and all that kind of stuff, and you know, sending everything you can to the NAACP legal defense, because that's like literally the biggest thing you can do, because you know, that's how shit gets settled in the world we live in, unfortunately, legally. Yep.
There's a motion right now. I just read this morning. There's a potential motion going through with council in Minneapolis where they're thinking about dissolving the police.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
It's so crazy how broken the system is, man. I was having this conversation with Tristan Young yesterday. It's just insane how not only corrupt everything is, just how out of control it's gotten. Hopefully things can get better, but you know, it remains to be seen. I'm waiting for, you know, bad things come in three, so I'm waiting for the third thing right now. Yeah. Maybe a comet will hit the Earth and put us all out of our misery.
There was supposedly a big asteroid that was coming by the Earth, I think, a couple of days ago.
Bring it on, universe. I'm ready.
Yeah, but you guys have a new episode of the Beats Army coming out soon, right? Am I correct?
We do, yeah.
What are you guys doing on this episode?
So the next episode is actually airing today, but by the time people are listening to this, it could be Wednesday. So our latest episode was the film, the awesome film, Hell or High Water. If you're into modern neo-westerns, fantastic. Has a lot to say about neo-capitalism, how it relates to the very poorest communities in America. The film we did was a wonderful, wonderful underground indie band called Timber Tambor from Ontario. And then the next episode that we're doing is going to be the film, the 1992 film Juice, starring Tupac Shakur, the album Lupe Fiasco, Food and Liquor, the legendary Food and Liquor album from Lupe Fiasco 2006. And then all the artists we feature will be Black American artists. So we're very, very much looking forward to that one. And it should be out next week.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to
checking out on our website.
Absolutely. MidrangeVancouver.com if you want to check out all past episodes of Beats on Repeat and Mickey's other podcast, Flux, as well as all our track and food stuff. And Tristan's got some good articles up there. And I'm actually going to be doing some stuff on, if anybody out there has read the book Normal People, the TV series just came out on CBC Gem. It was started airing on Hulu in the United States and all over the world last month, but we finally just got it. I'm going to be doing some writing on that as well, because I love that book and the series is pretty fantastic so far. So look for that, midrangevancouver.com. We do hope you enjoy this episode today with Andrew Morrison, editor-in-chief of Scout Magazine. He's fantastic. And
I could listen to Andrew talk for literally fucking hours. Like, I just kind of go into a trance when he's speaking.
Okay, you don't have to kiss his ass that much.
I'm completely serious. You'll understand if you've never heard Andrew on our show before.
Okay. Well, we hope you enjoy this episode and thank you for tuning in again. Andrew Morrison, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing weird, man. How are you?
I'm good. It's a beautiful Monday out today. I'm excited to be, you know, having you on the podcast and talking, and, you know, I haven't seen you in quite a while, but these are some weird times. But how's this whole pandemic treated you and you and the family and Michelle and everything?
It has been, you know, it's takes some getting used to. It's made me really philosophical about a lot of things, and made me, you know, look at the way in which we live our lives. And you know, it's made me glad of a lot of things, and just feel very fortunate that you know, we happen to live in British Columbia, and just about any, you know, nowhere else. And you know, feeling lucky so far, and at the same time feeling, and this is odd, but feeling a little bit looked after by our government. You know, however much I might regularly, you know, voice my frustrations about our government, both at the municipal and provincial level, but in this case, you know, I'm happy pretty much with all three levels of government and the way in which they've handled it. And I mean, just the way that I feel, like, without giving too much thought about it, just the way that I intrinsically am going about my day and my attitude, I feel like I'm being cared for, governed. It's weird. It's not the typical feeling that I have. I'm grateful for the expertise that we have at all levels, and that we're listening to science instead of, you know, the kind of bullshit that they're having to deal with down south. So So overall, I'm feeling deeply philosophical. I'm feeling deeply fortunate and very eager for it to be over. Because another thing I'm feeling is just, a little bit of powerlessness to help my friends who have been struggling through this. I want to be out there and eating out as many restaurants as I possibly can and doing what I can to help people who have supported us over the years. And, there's only so much we can do. Like we can make maps and draw up guides to where people can do takeout and who's reopening and do what we can to, to promote that. But, there are obviously limitations to what anyone can do right now, even the restaurants with only a 50% capacity. It's weird times. How are you guys?
We're good. It's we've been able to do a lot of podcasts throughout this whole thing. And
yeah, I'm grateful for that. It's been making me feel connected to people that I haven't otherwise been able to hang out with. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, no. It's been a lot of it has been fun. But it's been nice chatting with people, and we chatted with Carrie and James, and you're seeing a lot of great people out there do some really cool stuff, and really that part's been really fun for us to be a part of. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to talk to you today about kind of your position, as editor-in-chief of Scouts, but also just kind of your position as you were talking about, like the idea that you are part of the industry, but you don't technically work in the industry, but you mm-hmm. get to talk about it and report about mm-hmm. it. And as you're saying right now, it's kind of you're connected.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm doing good too, Jamie.
Yeah, we don't want to talk about it.
Question wants to both of us, so.
we assume that about you, Mickey.
I know, I'm usually pretty quiet during these. It's funny because we've been recording remotely, as you know. And the timing is really interesting when you're not with someone in person, that we've noticed, which kind of, we talked about in our intro of our last show with Paul and Romano. Mm-hmm. And now Jamie and I are actually in person. So it's a little bit more getting, I guess, sort of like transitioning from phase two into phase three. It's getting there's a little bit more normalcy with our show. Let's say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice.
Andrew, you should see his beard. It's this thing is.
It's gone a little crazy.
Yeah. Getting out of hand here.
I shaved mine off by accident. I bought a trimmer. Oh. I had been growing it since the beginning of the pandemic. And, I've had beards before, but I thought, oh, well, screw it. I can't cut my hair, so I might as well not cut my beard. And then I ordered on Amazon or whatever a beard trimmer because it was getting kind of unruly. And I'd never used a beard trimmer before. This is such a stupid story, but I'm going to tell it anyways because what else are we going to do? I just had it on the wrong setting and it was like almost like a Mr. Bean skit where I tried to even it out on the one side that I'd screwed up on and then went to the other side and it kept getting progressively shorter until I had like this terrible sort of like Nicolas Cage goatee mustache combo. And then I was just almost in tears. I shaved it all off. And now I'm back to square one. I look like a Marine. It's a bit weird.
Hey, this is coming from a person who A, cannot grow a beard to save his life. I've never had a beard. So I embrace anybody who joins my plight over here.
Your clean shaven long haired beauty club.
Yes.
Yeah, you're breathing rarefied air there.
And also Jamie's hair is like to his shoulders, so he doesn't have to worry about cutting it. I actually had the same concept as you, Andrew, except I was actually cutting my own hair at one point. So I basically just took a clump of the top of my hair, like my bangs and stuff, and just chopped it with scissors. And my hair salon just recently opened. I go to Axis downtown. Shout out to Axis. Been seeing the same hairdresser for like 12 years. And I go in there and she's like, wow, your hair looks like really good. I'm like, wow, I cut it myself. Maybe I should be saving all this money and just cutting it at home from now on. So things to think about.
Or you can just grow it out like me, have long hair.
Yeah.
I don't think that anyone could achieve what you have, Jamie. But thanks for the dreams.
There's a couple things I do want to talk to you about today. I mean, the one thing that's, I guess not even a silver lining, I guess maybe just a way of life right now. There's a lot of stuff that's kind of happening in our industry.
Mm-hmm.
I think you and I have been emailing a little bit over the past year, and I was kind of curious to talk about the future of dining. As someone who mm-hmm. doesn't actually own a restaurant, but as someone who writes about it, talks about it, what do you mm-hmm. see and what have you heard from other restaurateurs, people in the industry? Where do you see kind of the pathway going? I mean, the last episode we had was kind of optimistic and really, I came away from it feeling pretty positive from listening to Paul and Romano and how mm-hmm. they've did really well and they've found, as best as they can, to trying to find a way to, get ahead and stay afloat and find ways for new revenue.
Yeah.
What are you hearing from other guys?
Those guys, those are two bright siders if I've ever met them. I mean, I've worked on the floor with both Paul and Mano in the past, and you would never want to have anyone other than those two guys if the power were to go out in the middle of service during the dinner rush. They'll figure it out. They'll make a plan, and they'll make it happen. I think, you know, there's so many, I can't believe I'm quoting former U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, but there are so many known unknowns. And without knowing those, like the nature of those unknowns, it's really hard to make any kind of predictions for where we're going. But if past is prologue, I do think that in any kind of time of crisis, that restaurants are the first to suffer, and they're also the first to recover. What makes it a little bit, not a little bit, but a lot different now is that the nature of the crisis is such that going to restaurants is just impossible. That's where danger lurks, or it has lurked, right? And now that things are, you know, the case numbers are so low and we've transitioned from phase one into phase two, and soon from phase two to phase three. And, you know, we might have a vaccine on the horizon in late 2020 or early 2021. We know that, you know, that there's an end to this, that, you know, things might go back to some semblance of normal. And what we're seeing now, whether it's, you know, wrapped in, woven into movements against police brutality, or movements towards a universal basic income, or movements towards, you know, just equality, fairness, justice, et cetera, what have you. The hospitality industry is at the center of that. It employs a massive number of people of color who don't always get the fairest shake, to put it mildly. In gross understatement, you know, things obviously have to change. So why would we ever want to go back to what was normal, what was considered to be normal in the restaurant industry? So that's where my head's been at, is just, you know, trying to balance the optimism I have. You know, like I think back to, you know, the end of the First World War, or where you had, you know, almost 20 years of growth and, you know, a boom. And that's also in the wake of the Spanish flu pandemic of 1919. Or to give you a more finite example, like in June of 1940, the Nazis occupied Paris and everything sort of went underground. Dining just disappeared completely, because except for the Germans, because they would go to all the cafes and restaurants. So the industry was held hostage there for almost 5 years. And in July of 1944, Paris was liberated again. The patios were full. The people were dining immediately. Like the day that Paris was liberated in July of 1944, there were tables on the patio with champagne being poured. It's an industry that is famous for figuring things out, getting back on its feet, and moving forward, but it just can't move forward the way it was before. It's got to change in many respects.
Yeah. So you published on Scout on May 19th an op-ed by a gentleman named Andrew Simpson. Why not try and fix the broken restaurant industry before reopening it? And I'd messaged you about this, and I read it, and it definitely generated some, you know, some controversy and some reactions from a lot of people. There's a lot of comments on it. I just want to read this one paragraph, which I found very poignant. So Andrew Simpson writes, tell me why then do we disrespect food so much and care so little for people working in the industry? Why do we consider an industry that provides food and nourishment to be a low-skilled, low-paying field? Why do we demand the very best ingredients at the lowest prices and streamlined in the most convenient way possible? Why do we restaurateurs aid this terrible notion and continue to work with race-to-the-bottom prices, supplied and undervalue their product and labor with impossibly low menu prices? Most people who work in hospitality already know this, know who is to blame for this. But the more people who say it out loud, the better. The state of the trade is the customer's fault. Which I thought was kind of interesting, because he's definitely kind of bringing up a lot of things that we kind of, I've talked about in the past, about this industry, in the sense that, like, you know, if you travel anywhere, what's the first thing that most people look into? You know, where am I going to go for dinner? Where am I going to go for drinks? Where am I going to go party? You know, it's, we're definitely the lifeblood of communities and of cities. Yet we definitely undervalue these people and undervalue the people that work in the industry. And it's interesting for someone to kind of go, come out of their way to say that it's the customer's fault, because mm-hmm. we're the customer as well. I mean, we go out as much as that. But mm-hmm. it's interesting to kind of think of it that way, because what he's trying to bring up is the idea that we need to change the industry. And there's a lot of these systemic problems, as you brought up earlier with, you know, the tipping was kind of started because of slavery. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of other, you know, a lot of things that have kind of been built into the system for decades. And
as yeah, you're saying, if not more like centuries, but yeah. Yeah. And then there are communities around the world that have moved beyond it, that don't have a tipping culture, that do their best to pay a living wage. It's not without precedent. It's just that in North America, it's holding on. I mean, I'm just speaking specifically about the tipping model, you know, because it is at its heart an American practice. You know, this idea that it's incumbent upon the customer to tip for two reasons. One, because they want to show what a big shot they are. To put it plainly, that's not new. In fact, I think we've moved away from that when we start standardizing, you know, 15 to 20% tip out as being the social norm, the rule. I guess my point with tipping is that it's archaic, and it shouldn't be up to the customer to pay that wage. It should be up to the business to pay that, you know, extra money. It should be up to the business. And when Andrew Simpson says that the it's the customer's fault, he's talking about enabling the enablement of a system that allows for that to endure, and by their silence, it's acquiescence. They're permitting it to continue by engaging with it, by having normalized it, and making that the standard. Doesn't have to be that way. It didn't have to be that way. And it is still that way because they continue. There's no call for it. And it's also the idea that the value of food, this is something that he also brought up that I thought was really interesting. And it's not anything new to anyone who works in the trade, I don't think. But I think for a wider audience, it's important to know the real cost of food and fixing it up and turning it around and making a profit off it in, you know, an expensive city like Vancouver, where lease rates are the cost of operating a restaurant is just ridiculous. And the reactionary role of the government, how it gets in the way of restaurants doing what they need to do in order to survive. At every level, whether it's just, you know, patio permissions or getting certain licenses or getting plans approved, et cetera, where, you know, can you drink on a patio or can you get a liquor license for this place or that place? You know, it's just not a very permissive environment. So we all know that restaurants don't have a lot of good things going for them before the pandemic. So it's really made, I think, a wider audience look at what restaurants are facing and look at it seriously, look at the numbers and go, geez. I mean, that's the one silver lining that I think has come out of this is that it's making a wider audience look at these circumstances and say, I'm part of this problem, that I've allowed this to continue for so long. Well, we'll see what happens with it, but the conversation is being started, and it's my hope that there will be some substantive changes going forward.
Andrew, do you think that the European model per se, I'm not sure how many countries go off of the non-tip model mm-hmm. in the world. I'm assuming mm-hmm. it's most of Europe and obviously in Australia, obviously in Asia. Do you think how if that were to change as a result of this pandemic, say one of the quote-unquote silver linings, How would that even be possible, just the way our system is structured, the way the restaurant industry works now? Because you'd have to raise everyone's wages by a certain percent.
Yeah, and that means that the price of food would have to go up.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's where things get interesting. And you know, the idea that you can go out there and feed yourself a full meal in a restaurant, in a competitive restaurant, and have the price be under $15 or under $20 is just ridiculous when you think about it. You know, when you combine everything that goes in, the costs that go into making a meal for somebody, even if they get their ingredient, if their food costs are really manageable and low, and they have to be in Vancouver, you can't run any, like, even medium sized food costs in Vancouver without, in, you know, guaranteeing your a quick demise. You know, it has to be super, super tight for business to be viable here. And even then, it's you're not making a shit ton of profit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse my language and excuse my rambling. It feels like it's been about a year since I spoke to anybody.
We have E on our podcast, so you're good.
You swear away.
Yeah. My epiglottis and my tongue and my mouth is getting an exercise. Yeah. So I apologize to anyone who has to listen to this or dribble come out.
Well, you essentially, so you would need not only that to change, you would need obviously the food delivery system and obviously the pricing to change as well, along with probably three or four other things for that model to work here.
Yeah, it's got to start somewhere. You know, and you know, the other thing is that the dining environment in which we live in Vancouver, it's like a post-COVID, that kind of makes me more nervous. Like, how many of the dozens of locations of Earl's, Cactus Club, Joey, Brown's are going to go under? How many Donnelly spots are going to go under? You know, am I going to count on a single hand the number of those that aren't going to be able to make it? You know, or is it going to be all of them are going to be able to make it? And then in a tightened, hyper-competitive market where a small independent restaurant doesn't have the group buying power that, say, those guys do,
mm-hmm.
you know, how are they going to survive? How is a small, you know, 40, 50 seat restaurant going to make it through 2020 without the help of a dining public that suddenly really understands the value that they have to our communities? You know, it's either, you know, your neighborhood is dominated by these cookie cutter corporate restaurants, or you've got a bunch of these small independent spots. Where would you spend your money? You know, anyway, more rambling. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, it's definitely, I was reading about it today, I think on CTV or whatever it was, CTV Local. They were talking, I think they had an interview with Imad, and he was, he's obviously the owner of Global Group. But I guess what he was saying is when they first opened up Global Group, like at the end of May, they were busy for the first couple of days, but then after that, the numbers have been doodling and they haven't been consistent, and it's been really up and down.
Well, possibly that could be all that could have something to do with just everybody's individual economies at the moment. Their budgets are, and the uncertainty surrounding, you know, what's going to happen to everybody in the next, you know, 1 to 6 months. I don't know. And, you know, I'm spending accordingly. I have to be tight. You know, I've got a small family to take care of, you know, so I'm not going out there and bawling through, you know, as I certainly was with takeout during the first part of this marathon that we seem to be collectively engaged in at the moment. But right now with restaurants reopening, I have to be a little bit tight, you know, so I think that a lot of restaurants will see, you know, a lot of people swing by to say hello and to have a meal, and but not big corporate groups. You're not going to have a big table of 10 from Deloitte and Touche sitting down, you know, and having you know, bawling out on some 97 Sassicaia, you know, and having 8 courses. You know, you're not going to see expense accounts going to town. It's going to be, you know, date night on a budget instead of, you know, four times a month, maybe once a month. So it's going to suck for a while.
Yeah, and that's essentially the business model of Global Group, essentially, is to pack as many people into a limited number of seats as possible.
Yeah, that's the restaurant model. I mean, that's true. Exclusive to the Global Group. Yeah, it's not going to be easy. But I've, you know, when you think back to if we can go meta for a second, go big think and big picture and long term. If you go back to 2009. So the Great Recession took place, and you had, you know, I think I may have told the story before, maybe not to you guys, but you know, you had Vancouver. It was in a very important time in its development as a food city. I would even go so far as to say it was in its infancy, but it had started to take shape. You know, our values as a food scene. We were becoming more distinct from other cities in Canada, and we were really developing. We had a new crop, a new generation of restaurateurs who were doing new things, all in the name of Vancouver and its identity. And fine dining was really embracing that. You had restaurants like Gastropod open, and Fuel, and Danielle Ballou came here and took over from Rob Feeney at Lumiere, and it was a really exciting time. And then that recession happened, and it kicked everyone's ass and tightened up so many sphincters that chances weren't being taken anymore. And restaurants like Gastropod became Mainom. Restaurants like Fuel became Refuel. And later that shrunk down and became Campagnolo and Campagnolo Upstairs. But a guy as talented as Robert Belcham at Campagnolo, you know, he's doing burgers and comfort food, but he's boxing below his weight class. Let's put it that way. You know, there were substantive changes to our food scene, and the trajectory of it, where it was going, boom, sort of skyrocketing in the reputation of the world, you know, as a food city, it just came back down to earth with a crash. And we didn't really notice it at the time. It was just sort of put your heads down and work and toil, and restaurants kept opening. But they stopped being the kind of restaurants that they used to be. They started being restaurants like Meat and Bread, you know, and Tractor, and sort of counter service, sort of low overhead operations that focused on convenience and value and health. And that became the new Vancouver. But it's not just specific to Vancouver. That's how they've been rolling in Seattle and Portland and Los Angeles and New York. And, you know, after the recession, the food scene changed. It didn't stop. It just had a course correction. And I think that's probably what we're going to see again. And anyone who thinks that they know what it's going to look like this far out, from the freedom to make moves without hindrance, I mean, by that I mean with without a vaccine, we just don't know. So it's really interesting, like, especially in my line of work, where I'm always eyeballing restaurant projects that are in the pipeline, you know, places that are opening soon. A lot of people are pressing pause and giving a good, long, hard think about what their next moves might be.
Well, what have you heard? I mean, to talk about that specifically, I mean, you've published a couple of places that are opening up here pretty quickly. Cold Tea being one, Barbara. I think there was another one that you posted recently. What have those like restaurateurs said? Like, what does their optimism sound like in this, in these moments? Have they had to rearrange their plans, change their plans? Are they still going ahead with the kind of the plans that they had beforehand?
Well, I think that most of these, with the exception of Barbara and Cold Tea, are sort of still in that 2009 vein of do something really interesting. Flavorful, do, you know, one or two things that people really, really like, that people are familiar with, that is sort of really flavor forward and catchy and eminently Instagrammable, you know, and counter service, and your cost low, your operation low, but it's scalable, so that maybe if you do strike gold, you can open a second location or a third location, franchise it, you know. And that's how some people can make money. In the case of cold tea or Barbara, those are very different. And those are, you know, you rely on what Mickey was saying, was like the restaurant, the model of the industry of packing as many people into as small a space as you can, and squeezing them. That's what those guys are having to deal with now. Like at Cold Tea, I think it was they have a license for 160 capacity, 130 seated. And that's been
130? Holy.
Yeah. Dropped down to 65 or something like that. You know? And it changes the flow of the dining room. You know, they didn't design for this circumstance. The circumstance fell on their design. And so it's really interesting to see how people adapt to it. I mean, I don't think anyone's sort of closing their eyes and wishing it would just go away. They're having to adapt on the fly. And I think that people in the hospitality industry are legendary at being able to do that and somehow pull it off. So I have hope for everybody who's opening new spots in 2020. You don't always have great cards in your hand when you play poker, but you can still play the hand.
Do you know a lot more places that are imminent, that are going to be coming up soon?
I know. Yeah. I mean, out of every 10 places that I hear about that are opening, I'll only really care about one, just because I like to focus on places that I think are that can advance the ball, you know, of Vancouver's food scene, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, 9 places that are just basically looking to be the next Cactus Club. I should qualify that and just say, yeah, there are plenty that are sort of in a holding pattern. I won't talk about them specifically, but there are, I would say, close to a dozen restaurant projects that I'm personally aware of that I think would advance the ball of Vancouver's restaurant scene forward, but are now sort of on hold. And some of them were able to, one or two, I think, were able to, were just on the cusp of signing deals for signing leases, and have not. So they sort of are kind of back to the drawing board, but they put things on the back burner, to mix metaphors.
I would say that, I probably know about 3 or 4 that I know that are mm-hmm. probably still in the works. And, I've talked to the owners and the people involved, and I commend them on their optimism and their ability to still kind of push forward during this time. But I understand that sometimes once you've already kind of got the ball rolling, money's already been spent. So you kind of, you have to think about the sunk cost fallacy of the idea of, is it better to pull the plug now or just keep moving forward? So some people are willing to take that risk, and I commend them, and I wish anybody out there who's going to be opening anything soon all the best. And yeah, it's kind of weird, but I mean, when you're talking about pivoting and working ways into kind of restaurant, like as we talk about the idea that restaurants are going to come out of this completely different, I completely 100% agree. I've talked about this a million times over ad nauseum, and I don't mean to repeat myself, but counter service, I think it's going to be more prevalent than ever before. I think takeout and delivery is going nowhere. I think a lot of restaurants are going to definitely be changing their models. It's going to be, you know, I wrote a column about a month ago, kind of hearkening the idea that wait staff are going to be in limited quantity. That's for definitely sure.
Sadly.
But I don't know. I think that I agree with you on that. But
if we get more patios, though.
But I mean, this is Vancouver, where we have an annual rainfall of 157 centimeters or something like that. It's, you know, we're not in Victoria's rain shadow. We're wet and unpredictably so. So I don't know how patios can fix things. And it's really not so much about just dealing with the immediate restraints of COVID and what, you know, Dr. Bonnie Henry says we can and cannot do. This is about the fallout, the economic long-term, short-term and long-term fallout. Will people have enough money to comfortably feel like they are going, they can go out and, like, forget the pandemic? are people able to afford to go out and enjoy themselves for dinner? You know, and that's, to me, the big, you know, question going forward for the rest of 2020, like after they have a vaccine, 2021, you know, what is that season going to look like? And I also, I have a pet theory. This is an optimistic pet theory. It's a social theory. And that is that really rich people don't always want to dine with people who aren't really rich. And I think that people who have money don't really give that big of a shit about the quality of food or the dining experience. They just want the illusion of exclusivity, which explains the existence of many, many thousands of restaurants that are basically 22 caliber operations and 357 Magnum environments. You know, there are a ton of shitty restaurants out there that gear themselves toward being the exclusive palaces of the well-to-do. So I don't imagine that this pandemic or its aftermath is going to do away with the ruling class. And those Joes have got to eat, right? And they're not going to be eating at meat and bread. You know, they're not going to be eating at some small ramen place. They're going to want to go where they can be seen, and they're going to want to be waited on, and they're going to want to live in that same, dine in that same kind of environment that our restaurant scene has been propping up and holding on to for so long, since the Titanic sank. That you are my servant for the next hour and a half, and bring me the finest wine and cheeses in all the world. And at the end of it, if I think that you've done a great job, I shall reward you with a pittance of coins.
I know nothing of this.
What's a pittance?
It's a little bit.
A large amount. Oh, a little bit. Okay.
Yeah. But do you know what I mean? Do you really think that socially, structurally, that phenomenon is going to change? That the people who've got quite a bit of money, and this city has got a lot of people that have a lot of disposable income, mm-hmm. that they're going to want that illusion to come crashing down. They're going to want it to still be propped up, and there are going to be many restaurants out there that's their bread and butter. And you know what? That's the environment that I was raised in, you know, as a hospitality worker, you know, was creating and maintaining that illusion and making it as believable as possible. You know, that's the nature of hospitality, the industry that we have. It's much more like that than it is lining up at a cafeteria, you know, like a meat and bread operation, where it's, yeah, I'll have this and that, and here's my tray, and I'll pay down here, and then I'll go and wait and find a seat, and then I'll clean up, I'll bus up after myself and move on. There's no illusion in that. There's no hospitality in that. It's going to be interesting. I don't know. Again, I'm in my head. I think about this stuff a lot, and I do think that table service isn't going away anytime soon.
No. I would never say. I would never say it's going away. I would just say that it's going to go away for, you know, for the places that you're talking about that cater to that clientele. They're not going away. Mm-hmm. I mean, I stress that 100%. You know, if you go to you know, the Joe Fortes, the Giardinos, the Cactus Clubs, people, those places, they're not going to lose their waitstaff, because people that have money, that's where they want to go. They want to be seen. You know, they want to be, you know, as you're saying right now. And that's
yes, but that's then. But then there's another side of that, and that's the social currency that comes with going to the new place. Yeah. So in the immediate aftermath of 2008, 2009, and that crisis came the explosion of Gastown and Chinatown as being a viable place for casual fine dining to do business. We had a bunch of, you know, approachable, affordable lease rates, and people could go in there and fix it up and have it be something rustic with a little bit of finesse and accoutrement of fine dining, but you had the brick walls and the you know, inverted commas roughness outside on the street, you know, and boom, a new food scene was born. That was the trajectory that we took in Vancouver after that crisis, and it came with restaurants such as Laboratoire, you know, Kissitanto, Bao Bay. Etc. So if you think of the definition of Vancouver's, like, what is Vancouver's food scene? We don't talk about Joe Fortes, and we don't talk about the Cactus Club, at least not in a positive sense. We talk about restaurants like Bao Bay, Como Taberia, you know, places that are sort of the new thing. And there's that social currency in the newness of those things. And I don't think that's going to go away either.
So in a way, actually, you're bringing up a really cool point, which is, I never thought about this, actually, but the idea that, like, the COVID could really cause a lot of rents to drop. And because of that, we might have a generation of new restaurateurs who see that they can get affordable lease rates in some spaces that maybe were really expensive last year. And, you know, by 2021, 2022, they can find a lease rate. Like, I know, for example, like when Ron sold Mammy Taylor's, the two gentlemen that went in there and bought that place, they just left it. They didn't even bother once COVID hit, because they were about to start working on that. So that place has been empty for the last 3 months. And yeah, I don't know how much, he was paying before. I think he was paying like 13,000, but I'm sure, you know, anybody who's going to try to go in there right now, they're probably going to try to get a better rate of return. Lowball. They might try to lowball them, see if they can get it for like 7,000.
Know, so I mean, yeah. I have very little faith in commercial real estate landlords and their ability to give anybody a break. And these last few months in particular have made me think even less of them than I ever have before, which is saying something. So I'm not going to hold my breath for that, especially in neighborhoods like Gastown or Chinatown, where Mammy Taylor's is. I think to them, this is just a momentary blip, and that, you know, come 2021, it's going to be, you know, years of sunlit uplands of revenues. And, you know, maybe, you know, I also look with hope at, you know, even residential rent rates, and maybe servers and cooks will be able to afford to live in Vancouver now that Airbnb has sort of had to be sent scurrying with no tourists coming, and the, you know, a lot of one bedrooms coming on the market. But again, similar to commercial real estate agents, the rates haven't gone down. They're super. There might be a flood of new apartments, mysteriously fully furnished apartments, you know, former illegal Airbnb apartments. But you know, your average line cook or two line cooks living together wouldn't be able to afford them.
There's one on my floor been an Airbnb since I've lived there, and I've known this. There's actually two on my floor, and one of them just came online as a rental. And they first put it up as a furnished place for like, it was a two bedroom place for like $2,750. And they've been able to rent it for the last 2 months, and now it's like $2,300.
And I hope it keeps going down. And I hope those people stub their toes several times a day, because I think that they've done nothing for the city except make it more difficult for the people who live here.
Capitalism at its finest, huh?
I think that there's room for capitalism. I do, but I think that we have let it go a little bit too off the rails in the city, when the solutions are simple and straightforward, and they're not really punishing anybody except companies that are based in Silicon Valley that don't really give a shit about the state of Vancouver and its people. You know, I don't understand why it's incumbent upon the city of Vancouver and us as taxpayers to fund investigations as to whether or not an Airbnb apartment is legal or illegal. That should be incumbent upon the company. Otherwise, they shouldn't be able to operate here. That just makes perfect sense to me. But instead, you know, our city council goes groveling and makes a conditional arrangement with Airbnb. And still the users of that service continue to, in their thirst for greed, continue to screw over the people. So fuck them. Excuse my French.
Well, it seems like what could be another negative of this is, once again, the lower middle and upper middle and middle class getting fucked, as is in every other aspect of life.
Yeah, well, I'm more interested in the lower and the middle right now. I think that there have been solutions for these things that were around pre-COVID. And to see, you know, our city still dragging its feet on solutions today, like mid-COVID, if you think about what happened with Como Taperia and that and their patio fiasco, and how the city was like, no, you can't have a patio, and we don't really have the time to explain to you why.
Yeah, 48-hour whirlwind. I mean, they go from getting nothing. We talked to Sean about this about a year ago, and
and then one social media post.
Yeah. So
yes, which to me illustrates the spinelessness of the current city council. So what you're saying basically is, anyone who doesn't have a large social media following, who you denied a patio to, is screwed. Basically, so your scruples are determined not by the needs of this city and the commercial needs of this city and the societal needs of our neighborhood. Like that part of our city would be improved by more large sidewalk patios, you know. Anyway, Vancouver will be a wonderful city when they finish building it. That's how I keep saying to myself.
When is that going to happen?
Well, what's funny about that whole situation is the fact that, like, if anybody's been to Como and has walked by that corner, it's a really big sidewalk. You could easily have, like,
yes,
12 seats on both sides.
It's like three sidewalks.
Yes, massive. But all those things that you've just said are immaterial to bureaucracies. It's just move it from one desk to another desk, and I'm in no rush, and I'm going to have a break now.
I was talking to someone about this the other day, and they're talking about, like, a lot of, when it comes down to, like, city council and a lot of these decisions, lies that a lot of people just, like, as you say, no one wants to take responsibility because no one wants to get blamed for something. So they push it on to other desks and this and this. Like, even prime example, like when they had that, the city vote last week about, saying no to us being able to drink in city parks.
Yeah.
Like, not only that, but like Mayor Kennedy just decided to absently take a day off that day, like, just because he didn't want to be part of the vote. You know, it's just like the fact that, like, no one's questioning him on that. And then also, like, Dr. Patricia Daly is the person who comes in on May 27th to have this conversation with the city councilors. And she provides all this evidence. She's saying that, drinking during COVID has gone up 25% and that, people are, we shouldn't be encouraging this, and that BC has the highest rate of drinking per capita in Canada. I just want to kind of go up to her and, like, you say all these things to me, but then you don't do really much about the downtown east side. And then you forget about the idea that, like, people are stuck in their houses and they can't go anywhere right now, can't travel anywhere. Parks are some of the places that we want to go to.
Yeah.
And people are drinking
there right now. Yep. A statistician could prove somehow that, an elephant could hang off a cliff with its tail wrapped around a daisy. I really don't care what that person says. I'm a mature adult. And if I want to have a beer at the beach, I'm going to have a beer at the beach.
Yeah.
And if you treat me like a child, and you treat generations like children, which is what the city has done since its inception. Vancouver has always been a ass backwards backwater when it comes to, allowing its citizens to somehow figure out a way to entertain themselves. It's disheartening, but at the same time, it's totally not surprising. And I just wish that they would get the fuck out of the way. I'm sorry I'm swearing so much. I'm usually a much more optimistic, uplifting. I try to be.
It happens when people come on our show.
Really? You guys are just such bummers.
Part of it is also just like, this is podcast therapy. That's what we're doing today. We haven't talked in a while. We're excited to hear your voice.
So I'm just downloading all my grief.
our new name is Track and Therapy. That's what our new name
is. Yeah, I'm going to make myself a daiquiri now, and I'm going to just feel a lot better having gotten all this off my chest.
Yeah.
Well, it is really interesting to go back on what you said something at the very beginning, Andrew, is that how people are actually dealing with this who work in our industry. I've been fascinated by people's viewpoints and opinions because my mom has had a very holistic sort of spiritual view of it. Like, it's never happened in her lifetime. And she's just in awe of what's happening, that it's like brought so many people in a global sense to like the same exact point. Whereas you talk to people like Paul who are just like, they're like, nope, fuck this. I'm moving forward and I'm going to smash anything in my way and I'm going to make this work. So it's been a really interesting, from that perspective, to see everyone's, and obviously everyone's goes through ebbs and flows throughout, like on probably an hour to hour basis on just the gravity of the situation. But for me personally, like I said, it's been uplifting in a way to talk to people, but I kind of find myself on that walking that line of negativity and sort of like, this is really fascinating at the same time, probably because I'm on CERB and I don't have a job. And I probably, in all honesty, I probably will not go back to the service industry. And that's something I've been thinking about, like really, really intensely, like whether I'm going to go back because unlike some of the other places in here, my hotel at the my lounge at the airport is closed until August, and the rumblings are it's actually probably going to be closed until September. So, you know, and it's at an airport, so where does that really leave us, right? Because the hotel industry has in-room dining, right? So it's, I think it's a kind of a more specific area of service, but I mean, who knows?
Well, if we lose you, we will understand.
Good. I'm trying to think existentially about it.
Yeah. What would you do?
All I've done is I've worked. I started washing dishes at Earl's in Richmond when I was 16 years old.
Yeah.
I literally have no idea what I do. Maybe I could become a famous musician. Is that easy to do?
Yeah, man. Okay. Yeah, just don't worry about it. Just put your head down and play.
I would like to know, on a bit of a lighter note, what are you listening to keep your soul calm? What are you listening to right now? Favorite albums, favorite bands? Have you revisited nostalgic old stuff? Or have you found, are you a guy that likes to search out new noteworthy music? Or?
Well, there's like work Andrew, and then Andrew trying to figure out the world in his head, Andrew. So work Andrew, it's just basically the same stuff, which... Yeah. You know, right now has been a mix of, I don't know, what do we listen to, Michelle? Krangbin? We listen to a lot of Krangbin.
Oh, Krangbin. Very nice. Hipster points for that one.
We saw them live actually last year at the Commodore, and that was a really fun evening. And in fact, just thinking about being in that space, listening to that music with so many people, you know, crush together.
Very therapeutic, their music.
Yeah, we saw them in October.
Really?
Yeah, they were one of the headliners to the festival that we went down to in California.
Yeah, Desert Days?
Yeah, so they were there, and it was like them and Stereolab and Wu-Tang and
Wu-Tang
and Devo and the Black Angels. And yeah, it was great. It was great. Super fun. But their Krungbin was awesome. She's so sexy when she plays her bass. Ugh.
So is he.
Those hammer-ons are sexy, I'll tell you.
Let's objectify everybody in that band. That's a good-looking group. the other thing is that I'll retreat into things that have always made me feel good, you know, which is just music from my childhood, stuff like that, classical music, some opera, and like things like Kraftwerk, Pink Floyd, standard issue, old man stuff.
You feel old?
No, now that I've got no beard and a marine style haircut, I'm a young buck.
Mick, what are you listening to right now anyways?
I've actually been listening to a lot of my old, I grew up listening to a lot of hip hop.
Yeah, what are we talking about?
I've been listening to a lot of like De La Soul, even though you can't find their stuff on Apple Music anymore or Spotify because they were sued to shit for their first three albums. They didn't clear their samples, so you can't really find De La Soul's old stuff. You know, a track called Quest, anything from Q-Tip. I loved the Wu-Tang Clan growing up. But I also liked some West Coast stuff. Like, I was into Too Short. I was into, like, the Hieroglyphics. I was even into Tupac for a little bit, but not too much. But also older stuff like Eric B. and Rocky and Schoolie D and KRS-One. Like, that old East Coast.
Old East Coast New York Public Enemy
kind
of stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I know that Public Enemy, I think, is one of your favorite albums of all time. Their first one, right?
Yeah. No, second one. It Takes a Nation of Millions.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I love that record. It's so appropriate too for the,
exactly,
the last couple of weeks in the United States.
100%. You know? Absolutely.
That lyric, I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said, never. Anyway.
That sums it up right there.
Yeah, I love De La Soul too. That was the worm kind of turned for me when for hip hop, because I was listening to a lot of angry hip hop before. I can't remember what year it was, like maybe 88 or 89 when De La Soul came around to me, at least in my ears. That record, 3 Feet High and Rising, it was all about daisies.
Yeah, me, myself, and I was on that. I think.
Yeah, yeah.
It made hip hop fun, right?
Well, no, I mean, like, for me, Beastie Boys made hip hop fun, but it just gave it a different groove for me, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. It went from kind of like conscious political or whatever you want to call it to like more just like about chasing girls and stuff.
Yeah, less gold, less rope chains, and more African medallions. I remember it was a switch.
93, yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Jamie? What have you been?
You guys notice I have nothing to add to any of whatever you guys are talking about. Just I'm a straight rock and roll boy, so
Yeah, well. I'm a rock and roll boy too, man. I was just wigging out to Led Zeppelin in the car this morning. Communication breakdown. That's another go-to. That's really transportive music to me too. Like that'll put me in a time and place real quick.
Communication, so Led Zeppelin 1? Yeah.
And 2 and 3 and Physical Graffiti. You know, I'm just a fan.
Led Zeppelin 1 is probably my favorite. But no, I've been really digging my buddy Ripley Johnson. He's in this band called Rose City Band. He just released a new album, which I'm pretty stoked about. He's a lead guitarist in Moon Duo, and it's a band called Wooden Chips. I'm really digging it. It's kind of like a country rock and roll bluesy record. And hanging out with that. And I love the new Strokes album. It's really good. New Real Estate. I was into the new Tame Impala. I thought that was pretty good. So
looking forward to seeing live music again.
I'm very excited. Yeah, that's the part where I'm really depressed. So
when is that going to happen, though?
Well, I mean, that's not until 2022. As soon
as that's phase 4. No, as soon as we have a vaccine.
Oh, so next year. Well, the gyms are opening, I think, this month on the 17th, I believe.
Yeah, and the Canucks are going to be playing before the summer is through. At least 3 games before they get knocked out in a best of 5 series against Minnesota. I'm a huge Canuck fan, and this is the first spring. You know, I'm used to not being, not playing hockey, or not playing hockey, not being, being a Canuck fan in March is a fraught thing because you're either going to be in the playoffs or you're not going to be in the playoffs. It's when that kind of shit happens, right? When that determination is made. And I've got, you know, a 47 for me personally year history of March is an important month for me. You know, in that sense. And it was gone this year. And so was April. By now, we would have handed out a Stanley Cup probably last week, I guess, if my math is right. And it's the first time. Well, actually, I lived in Africa for 4 years in the 90s. So I didn't get to watch all those games. But I'm an 82 a year guy. So that's been... In retrospect, I think that's going to be one of the more difficult things I've had to endure is no hockey in spring.
Wait a second. You watch every Canucks game?
Every Canucks game. I've been a fan since about 1980 when, you know, I was about 7 years old and I started getting into hockey. You know, I played hockey when I was a little kid and I've just always been a diehard Canucks fan. So, I live and breathe the Canucks from all year, and that was a hard pill to swallow.
Well, hockey's coming back. I know the NBA is coming back. Baseball looks like they're going to be I think it's going to be a 72 game season. Hopefully, sports will be on their way soon. And anything you guys got coming down on the pipeline?
We're just enduring. You know, it's an interesting thing that's happened. You know, with because we're so umbilically tied to the hospitality industry, you know, we've seen, you know, an outpouring of support from people within the industry, which has been great. And we've never been busier from a readership perspective, which has been great that so many people are turning to Scout for information on, you know, especially now with restaurants reopening. And you know, it's been nice. Like it's financially difficult, but you know, one of the big misconceptions I think that people have about our company is that it's a big company. We've been around for 11 years now, and really, it's Michelle and I and a handful of fine contributors like yourself, Jamie, and we don't work out of an office in a tower in downtown Vancouver. You know, we're not spread out on a floor with cubicles. It's two people, you know, at our kitchen table. And it's always been that way. It's only able to operate with the support of its members. And it's been so gratifying to have our members and our friends step up and support us over the last few months. And it's just been about putting our heads down and doing the work and doing what we can to support our friends who we can't really imagine how hard it's been for them. You know, what's been really hard, I think, for us is not being able to actually be in the physical presence of the people that we care about. Do you know what I mean? Like when you've got, if I've got a friend who's got, you know, a bunch of restaurants and I can't just give her a hug, you know, and just say, I'm sorry that this is happening to you. That's been hard, you know?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with your sentiments more on that. I mean, me and Mickey, as we've done this podcast, we've talked about this even earlier. It's just the fact that, like, you know, not being able to see you right now, not being able to, you know, have our guests in person. And, like, and also we work in the industry. I mean, Mickey's a pretty social person when he's at work. I'm a very social person. If anybody's met me, and, you know, not being able to go to work for the last couple of months, and, you know, thank God we're going back to work next week. But, you know, I haven't been able to socialize and meet with people. And, you know, we went to Buffalo recently. We went to Bells and Whistles. We went to, you know, I've done a couple things, but even still, that's, you know, not everything's open, but slowly things are starting to reopen. So I know it's been a very trying time for a lot of people, and, you know, I'm really excited that things are hopefully starting to return to normal in some ways, and the people will be able to give each other hopefully some, you know, some elbow taps, and, you know, and say hello and see some smiles, and we can start revisiting that thing that we call hospitality again. And I know people have been doing a really good job as best they can with takeout and delivery, and you know, I know that's not the reason why people get in this industry, but, you know, that's what they have to do right now to maintain and stay alive, then that's what they got to do. And, you know, I hope as many restaurants are there as there was when we went through this. And and I just want to say thank you for coming on today. Thank you for all the great work you and Michelle have been doing up on the Scout. And
hey, man, it's good talking with you guys. One last thing to your readers, if I may, to your readers, to your listeners.
Listeners,
If you don't feel comfortable going out to restaurants, totally understandable. That's cool. Do what you can to, instead of doing delivery, do takeout. Because every meal that you get takeout rather than delivery, you're putting, you know, 25 to 30% of their profits back into the company, as opposed to giving it to a company like Uber Eats that doesn't really give a damn about what happens in Vancouver's food scene. Okay? So that's my last uplifting note.
You heard everyone.
Okay.
No, thanks a lot, Andrew. Great talking to you again. Yeah,
good looking talking to you guys.
To you in person.
All right,
in the flesh. Beer's on me.
Absolutely. Have a great day, Andrew. You take care.
Cheers.